God. And so they would be considered prophets. Which period of time is covered in the book of Joshua? Okay, the answer given in the book is 1460 to 1435. Did anybody come up with a different date in looking at commentaries? I said the book says 1460 to 1435. That's not the date commonly given. And let me tell you the date commonly given. Go with me over to 1 Kings chapter 6 and verse 1. Came to pass in the 480th year after the children of Israel had come out of the land of Egypt, in the fourth year of Solomon's reign over Israel, that he began to build the house of the Lord. Now the actual date of the Exodus is a matter of some disagreement among historians. We just don't have a lot of independent correlation of events. So there's a matter of speculation there, but Solomon's reign, historians agree, we know when Solomon's reign began about 970 B.C. So the fourth year would be approximately 966 B.C. Take 966 and add 480 to it, and you come up with 1446. That would be the year of the Exodus. Remember he said from the time they came out of Egypt until the time of the fourth year of Solomon's reign was 480 years. So 1446 would be the Exodus. The invasion would be 40 years later, which would be about 1406. I think he's transposed his digits there. He's got 1460, it should be 1406. So write in your book 1406 and the math that I just gave you, 1 Kings chapter 6, verse 1, and 966 plus 480 minus 40. So the time period would be about 25 years, and it's from about 1406 to 1381, doing the math, 25 years from 1406. How long did it take Joshua and the troops to subdue the land?
7.5 years.
6.5 years.
7.5.
7.5 years. And how do you know that, John?
Joshua, we go over to Joshua and Caleb's account, and I believe it's in chapter 11.
Exactly. Well, okay, chapter 14, actually.
Is it 14?
It's chapter 14 and verse 7 of Joshua. Caleb tells us, I was 40 years old when I was sent out to spy out the land. He's arguing in verse 12, give me my inheritance now. The reason for giving him his inheritance then was the land was subdued. It was time to partition out the land. He says, these past 45 years, so he's now 85. So take that 45 years, subtract the time from when they went out to spy until they invaded the land, and you've got the time generally given for the conquest. From the time they left Egypt until the time they spied out the land was approximately a year and a half. And the reason given for that is they didn't leave Sinai until the end of the first year. The text says they went up from Sinai in the first month. So they had left Egypt in the first month. And so it was about a year when they left Sinai. Actually, it was the second month, the end of the month, 20th day of the month when they left Sinai. And if you allow for 3-4 months for them to get there to the borders of the land and to send out the spies, that's approximately a year and a half from the time they left Egypt till the time that they sent out the spies. So to take Caleb's account, 45 years, subtract the 38 and a half, they would have been wandering from the time they sent out the spies until the time of the invasion, and you come up with around 6.5 to 7.5 years. Roundly, most people give 7 years. So that's the time period we're talking about, beginning in 1406, about 7 years, they conquer the land and subdue it, to the point where they're partitioning up the land, and Caleb is getting his inheritance. Okay. So, there's a little bit of time there that I think is really important for us to get in context, starting in 1406. We talked about Wednesday night the purpose of the book, to demonstrate the fulfillments of God's promises. This is history, yes. We're not just here because we love history. This is history with a purpose. History with a purpose. We want to know how God deals with man. Just like if you go take a class at any major university, you want to know, what kind of test does he give? What kind of questions does he answer? How does he do his lectures? How can I interact with the professor? We want to know how God deals with men. How does he treat them? Does he fulfill his promises? That's a major question we want to know when we approach God's word. This is history with a purpose, to answer those questions and give us the assurance that yes, God does answer or fulfill his promises. He is trustworthy. He is faithful. Who wrote the book? If you read the lesson book, you're going to see him kind of waffle on this. But Joshua's own testimony says that he wrote it. Now we know that just as the book of Genesis closes with the death of Moses, and obviously Moses didn't write about his own death, the book of Joshua is going to close with the death of Joshua, and he obviously didn't write in the past tense about his own death. So surely there was some addition, probably by those that were in power, those that were priests, most likely. But Joshua, by his own words, says that he wrote the book. And so we must credit him with the vast majority of the book. He also had in his lesson book factors for how Israel could have such success in taking over the land. He says at the top of page 2, how could this loosely organized confederacy of tribes like the Hebrews invade and conquer the land? And he mentions that the power of the Canaanites to resist invasion was at a minimum. Just prior to the Hebrew invasion, Canaan had been the scene of a devastating war between the Egyptians and the Hittites. This war incidentally left the Canaanites so weakened that they could offer no forceful resistance to determined invaders. I say to you that's absolutely not a completely accurate picture, because they certainly did offer up significant resistance. You are going to see in the coming chapters what difficulty Israel faced at Ai. There was a significant resistance. But whether this was true or not, God gave them the land. God gave them the victory. We saw the promises given, even back in Exodus. God says, I'm going to give you the land, and when you go in to take it out, I'm going to drive out the hornets, people from before you. It's not just you. I'm going to drive them out. And so that takes us to question number 6. Why did God command Israel to exterminate the Canaanites? We ended class Wednesday night with the question of, well, weren't they commanded to exterminate the residents of the land and make no covenants with them? And that's true. And so we're going to talk about that a little bit. Go back with me to Exodus chapter 23. Now, the question I'd like to bring up is, how could Israel go and destroy the inhabitants of the land? And that's men, women, and children. That sounds harsh. That sounds totally at odds with what we would consider to be godly behavior. The accusation made by the unbeliever is that the Israelites were simply cruel, and God is a cruel God. But let's look at what God has said about the situation. Back in Exodus chapter 23, verse 23, part verse 22. But if you indeed obey his voice and do all that I speak, then I will be an enemy to your enemies and an adversary to your adversaries, for my angel will go before you and bring you into the Amorites, Hittites, the Perizzites, the Canaanites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites, and I will cut them off. You shall not bow down to their gods, nor serve them, nor do according to their works, but you shall utterly overthrow them and completely break down their sacred pillars. So you shall serve the Lord your God. He will bless you, your bread and your water, and I will take sickness away from the midst of you. And so on. He says in verse 28, and I will send hornets before you, which will drive out the Hivite, the Canaanite, and the Hittite from before you. I will not drive them out from before you in 1 year, lest the land become desolate. Little by little I will drive them out from before you. We're going to see in the coming chapters of Joshua in their third major battle that when the time comes to fight, it's not the Israelites slaughtering all the people. For it says, God sent a hailstorm, and the mighty hailstorm, more died from the hailstones than died from the swords of the Israelites. So this is God destroying the people, first and foremost. So first and foremost, as we deal with that accusation, we have to acknowledge, first of all, does God have the right to judge? As creator, he absolutely has the right to judge. This is not a frivolous judgment. In fact, we recall the promises given to Israel. He said, the land is not yours, for the iniquity of the Amorites is not yet full. And quite a long period of time went by before the time of the Amorites' iniquity was full and this judgment occurs. If God has the right to judge, God has the right to utterly overthrow. And it's not the Israelites doing this on their own. It's God doing it through them. Keep in mind, this is not the only time in history these kinds of things happen. In fact, these kind of things happen to the Israelites. If you go and read Isaiah, you see Isaiah make the statement in chapter 10 and verse 5, Assyria is the rod of my anger, in whose hand is my indignation against Israel. Assyria came in and demolished the Israelites. Why? Because God judged them. Just as he had judged the nations before them. In fact, he tells them when they come into the land, he said, beware and follow my commandments, lest the land vomit you out, just as you destroy the nations that you're going in to destroy. So, if God has the right to judge, and God is the one executing this, he's leading the charge. It's not the Israelites leading the charge, it's God. And we have to accept this as God's judgment. It's not an easy question to deal with. It makes a lot of Christians uncomfortable. It should cause great fear in our hearts that if God judged them because of their disobedience, what will he do to us today because of disobedience? We will not stand justified. We will be judged as well. For his power to judge has not been diminished in these many years. Any comments or questions about that? Who was the judgment against? The Canaanites. It's a general term. Look with me over in Deuteronomy chapter 7, verse 1. Very specific. When the Lord your God brings you into the land which you go to possess, and has cast out many nations before you, the Hittites, the Girgashites, the Amorites, the Canaanites, the Perizzites, and the Hivites, and the Jebusites, seven nations greater and mightier than you. He identifies them specifically, seven nations. These are the ones which you are not to make any covenants with. For he says in verse 3, you shall not make marriages with them, you shall not give your daughter to their son, nor take their daughter for your son, for they will turn your sons away from following me. In verse 2, he said, you will conquer and utterly destroy them, you shall make no covenant with them, nor show mercy to them. So there's the context for the beginning of Joshua. He makes the last question there is about the vision of the book. And he makes a good point in his lesson. There's 24 chapters in Joshua. The first 12 are given to the conquest of the land. The first 12 are given to the conquest. So he's labeled uniformly in his lesson plans, Conquest of Canaan, section 1. So if we get into a little bit of a review of chapter 1, and then I want to cover a couple things that we didn't touch on earlier. He's made a statement up front: be strong and courageous, for God has given you the land. And the order comes across Jordan, and he said, prepare yourselves, for in 3 days we're going to cross. And then he has a lot to say to the Reubenites and the Gadites and the half tribe of Manasseh. This is pretty important, I think. It goes back to Deuteronomy chapter, I made a note. The situation is this. The people had seen some of the land. The people of Reuben and Gad had a lot of livestock. And they saw the land. The plains east of the Jordan looked good for livestock. And so they came to Moses and said, look, this land east of Jordan looks really good because of our livestock. We'd just like to have that land east of Jordan. Moses had a lot to say to them. It was very harsh because it seemed as though they were saying, we want this easy land. We don't want to have to go take the hard land. We want the easy part. And so in verse 14, he says, look, you've risen in your father's place, a brood of sinful men, to increase still more the fierce anger of the Lord against Israel. For if you turn away from following him, he will once again leave them in the wilderness and will destroy all these people. And so they said, look, we will build sheepfolds here for our livestock and our cities. But we ourselves will be armed and ready to go before the children of Israel until we've brought them to their place. And our little ones will dwell in the fortified cities. But we will not return to our homes, verse 18, until every one of the children of Israel has received his inheritance. And so Moses promised them that land. So when we get to staging, before we're going to cross the Jordan, we're staged. Joshua has an admonition to these same groups. In verse 13, he says to the Reubenites, the Gadites, and half the tribe of Manasseh, remember the word which Moses commanded you, saying, the Lord is giving you this rest and is giving you the land. Your wives, your little ones, and your livestock shall remain in the land which Moses gave you on this side of the Jordan, but you shall pass before your brethren armed, all of your mighty men of valor, and to help them, until the Lord has given your brethren rest. In other words, you will fulfill your duty as you have promised. He's admonishing them. And their response in verse 17, just as we heeded Moses in all things, so we will heed you. Only the Lord your God be with us as he was with Moses. So, they come to this point, and they're ready to fulfill their promise. Verse 18, whoever rebels against your commands and does not heed your words, in all that you command him shall be put to death. Only be strong and courageous. See that phrase as we talked Wednesday night over and over again, strong and courageous. This is history with a purpose. Why? That you be strong and courageous. So Joshua sends out the spies and he tells the people in 3 days we're going to leave. And he sends out the spies and says, spy out the land in 3 days. So is their decision to leave based upon the report of the spies? Really is it? The picture you see is in 3 days we're going to leave and go take the land. The spies are going to come back in 3 days. So when they come back, is their report going to change what we're going to do? The indication is no. No. It might influence how they go about what they're going to do, but they are committed at this point to crossing and taking the land. Now we have a lot to say about Rahab. The spies went into the house of Rahab. The primary purpose in the text is they lodged there. They lodged there. We don't know how they came about, whether she approached them or they approached her. It wouldn't be surprising if she approached them. She may have. Some have commentators have said she might have met them outside the city. It's clear that these men were foreigners. This was an area that would be on a trade route, so it would be uncommon to have foreigners come through. But keep in mind the position of the city of Jericho. They know who's encamped, and they know that there's a million plus people sitting out there east of the Jordan. They fully expect where they're coming. They know what the plan is. They're looking for spies, because they know that's what anybody would do. So when the spies come, they are probably recognized somehow. And the king knows about it, and he sends for them, and Rahab lies. And the question that's always given by many people, we talked about Wednesday night a little bit, is, well, the Bible doesn't condemn her harlotry. The Bible doesn't condemn her lying. I say to you that, yes, it already has. Remember, she's a group of people. She's part of a group of people that has been condemned, has been judged. And God has said, go in and destroy them. Her behavior, like the behavior of those around her, have already been condemned. God didn't need to specifically say harlotry is wrong, Rahab sinned. Lying is wrong, Rahab sinned. He has said her people are worthy of death. That's judgment of God. So let's don't get caught up over harlotry and lying. What becomes a barrier to many people is the fact that she lied as part of this agreement. And Doug brought up Wednesday night, weren't they not supposed to make an agreement with the people of the land? That's true. We just read from Exodus and Deuteronomy 7 where they were not to make any covenant with the people of the land. So why did the spies make this covenant? The easy answer is, well, their life was at stake. Their lives were in her hand. And they made this agreement under duress. Nowhere in the text does it judge it as being God's will or not. But obviously God allowed it to happen. What kind of report did the spies bring back? What did they say? Isn't it interesting, the report they brought back? Sarah? Rahab says, look with me in verse 8 through 11. Apparently they were ready to lodge for the night, for she goes up on the roof where they were hidden before they lay down, the indication being it was dark or close to dark. They were prepared to settle in for the night. She goes up to them and says, look, I know that the Lord has given you the land, number one. This probably was not a conclusion that she came to on her own. Probably common knowledge. The reason I say that is look at what else she has to say. The terror of you has fallen on us all. All the inhabitants of the land are faint-hearted before you. For we have heard how the Lord dried up the water of the Red Sea for you when you came out of Egypt. And what you did to the two kings of the Amorites who were on the other side of the Jordan, Sihon and Og, whom you utterly destroyed. And as soon as we heard these things, our hearts melted. Neither was there remain any more courage in anyone because of you. The Lord your God, he is God in heaven above and on earth beneath. She's taking common knowledge of events that the people knew. Two great events, crossing the Red Sea, miraculous crossing, and this destruction of the kings of Sihon and Og weren't easy kings to put down. Anybody remember anything about the king of Og? You go back in the text, you'll read that he had an 8-foot long bed. Apparently a very tall man, very strong man, probably similar to a number of people that served under him. These were not easy nations to put down. And her testimony is, you have done this, and we know it's by the power of your God. Now, she knew this knowledge, but everybody else did too, didn't they? Everybody knew this knowledge, common knowledge. Two reactions. For a lot of people, there's just fear and terror. For her, there's a determination to escape the judgment to come. You can see that in her actions. She hides the spies, and she does it for a purpose. She does it for a purpose. Therefore, in verse 12, I beg you and swear you, as I have shown you kindness, that you will show kindness to my father's house. This demonstrates a level of trust. Trust is belief, trust faith. What did she believe? Number one, that God had given them the land. Number two, that God had given them the victory. Therefore, her city was likely to fall, and she would be destroyed or taken into captivity. What would she expect? I have to escape the destruction. She chose to try to escape the destruction. I say to her, the situation is very similar to ours today, isn't it? We tend to have this mind block because she came to God by lying. How do we come to God today? Do we come to God because of our righteousness? We come to God in our sin. We come to God because of our sin. We come to God because the wages of sin are death. Our coming to God is somewhat similar to Rahab in the sense that we see destruction, we want to avoid it, we submit to God. We come to God in our sin. It's God that does away with the sin. So let's not get caught up in the fact that she came to God by lying. Remember, she had no instruction on how to come to God. All she knew was, I want to escape the destruction. I know the sure escape to destruction is through this God who has power. I want to submit to Him. The same way we come to God. Recognize the destruction to come. Submit to God. Doug.
This is, seems to be a direct fulfillment of the prophecy in Exodus 15, 16.
Exodus 15, 16, you want to read that for us?
Fear and dread shall fall upon them by the greatness of thine arm. They shall be as still as stone till thy people pass over, Lord, till the people pass over which thou hadst purchased.
It certainly seems to be a direct fulfillment of that, doesn't it? That's exactly what's happening. So when the spies come back, and of course they make a covenant with her, we see in the last part of the chapter, verse 13 and 14, she says, I want you to spare my father, my mother, my brothers, and my sisters, all that they have, and deliver their lives from death. So the men answer her, our lives be for yours. If none of you tell this business. So they're making a covenant with her. Is that in contradiction to what God said? Certainly seems to be. Certainly seems to be. But she lets him down by a rope through the wall. For remember, it's what time of the day now? It's night. Remember, when the king comes to her, she says, well, they went out and the gates are closed. Remember, they opened the gates so the team could go out to seek for them, and then they closed the gates behind them. So it's night. Gates are closed. It's hard to get out of the city at this point without being observed. How?
Hebrews 11, chapter 4, not for.
It's interesting, isn't it? Commended for her faith because she trusted in God and believed in Him and sought to escape the destruction. It's not that she's commended for her high moral attributes at this point. But what did she do when she came to God? We know from history that she apparently lived a good life. She married into the family of Messiah. Apparently was a faithful person. So regardless of what came before, she submitted to God, and she apparently lived by the laws.
In the book of James, she commended for her good work.
Right. Because she helped the servants of God by faith, trying to submit to God. That's the same challenge we have, isn't it? Trying to submit to God and follow His ways. So, I say to you, I don't think she's an exception. And it's a good example to point out, there are people today that say, well, you know, I can never be a Christian. You know, I've just lived this life of sin all my life. I could never be that person. Look at Rahab. Was she a high moral character? Indications were not. A harlot. But she came to God. She came to God. You can too. What does God say when He talks about blaming vengeance upon those who know not God and obey not His will? The judgment is not against those who aren't perfect, the judgment against those who will not obey. That's the primary distinction. So it's not about perfection. It's about acknowledging God, submitting to Him, and obeying Him. And this is what Rahab started doing at this point. So they make this covenant in the last few verses of Joshua chapter 2. When we come to land, you bind this line and start toward the window, and all your family better be assembled into that dwelling place. And it shall be that whoever goes into the doors of your house or outside the doors, his blood will be on his own head. We will be guiltless. In other words, our covenant is bounded to this. And if you tell this business of ours, verse 20, then we will be free from your oath, which you made us swear. And she said, according to your words, so be it. She sent them away and they departed. Bound the scarlet cord in the window, and they departed and went to the mountains and stayed there 3 days until the pursuers returned. Now this is an interesting point. I differ with the writer of the textbook here. The writer of the textbook says it's hard to reconcile these 3 days with their admonition to go spy out the land, because it seems like all they did was go into Jericho and then hide in the mountains. If you look in your lesson book, bottom of first page of lesson one, page 3, since the reference of 3 days is difficult to reconcile with the spying of chapter 2. Spies searched out the country before they were hidden by Rahab.
Same 3 days.
How do you know that? Is there any indication in the text that they searched out the land before they went to Jericho? Remember, the focus was to search out the land, but focus on Jericho. Jericho would be right up front, probably the place they might go to first. So from the text, I would argue, it appears they went to Jericho first. They were probably in Jericho for less than a day, because they went out after dark, probably the same day they went there. Seems to be the indication. And they went into the mountains and stayed for 3 days, and then they come back. They went to the mountains and stayed for 3 days to escape those who were seeking them out. That was by the advice of Rahab, actually. Commentators all look at say that these 3 days that they spied out the land were the same 3 days that Joshua said back in chapter 1. Chapter 1, verse 10, Joshua commanded the officers of the people, saying, pass through the camp, and command the people, saying, prepare provisions, for within 3 days you will cross the Jordan. And then he sends the spies out, and this appears to be about the same time. So that when the spies come back, the 3 days are fulfilled. They're ready to go. So they did spy out the land. They had 3 days in the mountains, and I doubt they just sat in a hole. They probably were looking around. But the purpose of the spying, interestingly enough, when they come back, they don't give a great military appraisal that we know of. It's not recorded, because it's apparently not important. What they saw militarily was probably not important. The key thing they gained from spying out was the people are faint-hearted before us. That fits in very well with the message of Joshua when he says, be strong and courageous. God has given us a land. And the spies come back and say they are faint-hearted because they know it's true. So the purpose, I would argue, is not just military. Its primary effect was to prep the people for what is about to happen, because God has given it to them. Look with me quickly at some of the questions at the end of lesson one. What factors should encourage Joshua to be a good encourager? And this really goes back to chapter 1, the first 9 verses. What factors would encourage Joshua to be of good courage? It's not just an admonition, it's an admonition with evidence.
God said that he would not fail him or forsake him.
Okay, he said, the Lord your God will never leave you. He will be with you wherever you go. What else did he give to them, Sarah?
He promised them the victory.
He promised them the victory. And he said, I will fulfill the promises that I gave you. You will divide the land. Back in verse 6, right? So what disposition should Joshua have toward the law as a result of these same verses?
Obey.
Okay, to obey it.
Do not depart either right or left.
Do not turn to the right. Do not turn to the left. Obey the law.
He said meditate on it day and night.
Meditate on it day and night. Isn't that interesting? Rob had a lot to say about that. Good stuff. Meditate on it day and night. I work at an engineering firm, and there is often the question that comes up, especially among those that are newer, only been with the company 1, 2, 3, 4 years. They come in and they have this sense of, whatever seems right to me, that's the path I'm going to get. And I'm usually quick to point out to them, no, you can't do it just however you want. We have an engineering practices manual. You must obey the engineering practices manual. Well, that just doesn't seem right to me. It doesn't matter. You're working for a company that pays you to do it according to the practices manual. It's almost a religious talk with me, because isn't that true of us? God has given us what he wants us to do. And we might think we've got some better way, but God says that doesn't matter. You work for me, you are mine, you follow my commandments. Don't turn to the right, don't turn to the left. You think about them. And I meet people all the time that have been working for the company for 10, 15 years, and they don't know what's in the manual. And have to tell them, well, go read the manual. Well, can't you just tell me what's in the manual? Kind of like people come to church and say, preacher, tell me what's in the book. How does it get in your heart? Meditate on it day and night. If it's important to follow, it's important to think about. It's important to put in your heart. It's important. That's the key. It has to be important. You're not going to meditate on it day and night. You're not going to put it in your heart unless you're convinced it's important. I've known people in my life that I go into their house, and it may be a social occasion, but I'm not in their house more than an hour, and they've got some question about the Bible. Why is that? You ever notice that about people? Because they're thinking about it. They're thinking about it day and night. Very important. What disposition did the tribes that settled east of Jordan have toward helping conquer Canaan?
They were very willing. They had set up camps, built pens for their cattle, and as soon as that was over with, they, or at least part of them, joined in the battle.
They were willing to leave their homes behind, leave their families behind, to go do the work which they committed to do. A tremendous shift, isn't it, from 38 and a half years earlier, where it was, we can't, it's, we will. How many spies? He sent 2 men. What were Rahab's moral character? Why did she choose to hide the spies? It's clear. She saw imminent judgment, imminent destruction. She wanted to avoid it. Wow. That's powerful. Did she sin when she lied about the presence of spies? Absolutely. No question about that. The Bible doesn't have to specifically condemn that kind of behavior. It's condemned her nation. Everywhere else in the Bible, God talks about lying. He talks about it being condemned. What did Rahab believe about God? We just talked about that a few minutes ago. He's given them the land, and he alone is God. He alone is God. That's a powerful statement, too. I mean, it's one thing to say your God is powerful. But think about the mindset of the nations at this time. They were idolaters. They often had a common god called Baal. Baal worship was common. Other gods too. But what was unique about Baal was, this word Baal literally meant husband. This nation has their Baal or husband. This nation has their Baal or husband. And you know, your Baal might be a little bit more powerful than mine, but guess what? They're both Baals. So it's easy for someone to see Israel coming in and say, oh, well, okay, looks like your God's a little bit more powerful than mine. He's just like all the other gods, but he's just a little bit more powerful. Okay, no. That's not the idea she had at all, is it? She said, he is God alone. There is no one like him. In the history of the world, they had never heard of any God that had done such a thing for his nation. He is God alone. That's the attitude that she had. And I say to you that that's not just her. That's the power of the evidence, the weight of the evidence. So she made an agreement, her life with their lives. What did the spies report to Joshua? We just talked about that. The inhabitants are faint-hearted. Okay, and that gets us to the end of chapter 1. Any comments or questions on the lesson this morning before we close? Anything that you see that we haven't talked about? Sarah? That's right, she saved her family.
And that took a lot of, probably, she had to teach. And she's a quickly get them on board.
Isn't that interesting? She could convince them so quickly. Within 3 days, they would all gather, because they did. So I again argue that this understanding that she had of judgment and destruction was coming, it was not just her idea. It was common knowledge. But she said, look, I've got a way to escape the destruction. Let's submit to this God. That had to be her answer. And her family followed her. Comment on the back of the bench.
Do you think if Joshua would have inquired of God about the spies, that he would not have deceived or defeated?
I'm sorry, say again.
Do you think if Joshua inquired
the question is, did Joshua, or could Joshua have inquired to the Lord and so that these spies would not have been deceived, or that he would not have been deceived? He would not have been deceived by the spies. There's no indication the spies didn't tell Joshua everything that happened. There's no reason to believe that Joshua was deceived at all about the spies. The question is, how did Joshua respond when they said, we made a covenant with Rahab? Apparently, as we learned from the text, he agreed to honor that covenant. Whether that was of his own authority or whether it was from God, we just aren't told. We aren't told if God spoke to him and said, I will honor this covenant. We just aren't told. We don't know. But they did, and God was still with them. So lots of good messages in this lesson. Yes. God knew the fact that God did fulfill the plan as an indication that perhaps he accepted this covenant. Okay, good comment. And I forgot to mention that when I talked about God conquering the land, we talked about the hornets, the walls fall in. We see that in the next lesson. That didn't just happen by chance. Of course, there's a lot of controversy in the archaeological world about that, what the evidence really indicates. But we believe that certainly God caused the wall to fall. And so that was God taking care of it. That was God taking the measures. So look at